Hey everyone, glad you're joining us today. I was just thinking about that moment, we've all had it, where someone says something so perfectly calculated to get under your skin that you feel like your brain just catches fire. You want to snap, you want to shout, or maybe you just want to sink into the floor. But what if the goal wasn't just to survive that moment, but to become what psychologists call unoffendable?
That's a powerful concept, Lena. It's not about being a doormat or just pretending you don't have feelings. It's actually about recognizing that when someone tries to make you snap, they are essentially trying to rent space in your head for free. It's a physiological heist. Your heart starts racing, your muscles tense up, and suddenly the smart part of your brain, the prefrontal cortex, just checks out, leaving the instinct brain to run the show.
It's wild how fast it happens. One snide comment and suddenly my biology is convinced I'm being hunted by a predator. But the research shows that staying calm isn't just a personality trait you're born with. It's actually a set of micro skills that anyone can learn to shield their nervous system from that hijack.
Exactly. And that's what we're diving into today. We're going to look at how to stop the birds from building a nest in your hair, as the old saying goes. We'll explore why your body reacts that way, and more importantly, the specific quiet tactics used by people who seem completely unflappable, even when they're being criticized or provoked.
I love the idea of quiet tactics, things you can do right in the middle of a heated exchange that no one even notices, but that completely change the temperature of the room. So if you've ever felt like you're at the mercy of other people's drama, stick around. We're going to break down the mechanics of composure.
It's all about moving from reactivity to reflection. Let's start by looking at what's actually happening inside your body the second that provocation hits.
So, Miles, you mentioned the instinct brain taking over. When I feel like I'm about to snap, it literally feels like I lose control of my thoughts. What's the science there?
It's a process called flooding. When you interpret a comment as a threat or a personal attack, your amygdala, the brain's alarm system, kicks in. It floods your system with stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline. Your blood pressure spikes, and your body actually pulls blood away from the logical centers of your brain and sends it to your muscles so you can fight or flee. You're basically operating on survival wiring at that point.
No wonder it's hard to think of a calm response. My brain literally isn't getting the resources it needs to be smart. It's just trying to keep me alive.
Precisely. And the mistake most of us make is trying to solve the problem while we're in that flooded state. But people who stay calm have learned to insert a psychological pause between the stimulus, the mean comment or the criticism, and their response. 2023 research actually shows that this pause allows those slower, higher-order reasoning processes in the prefrontal cortex to catch up and influence how we perceive the situation.
So the pause isn't just about counting to 10. It's about giving your brain the literal seconds it needs to move from the amygdala back to the prefrontal cortex. But how do we actually do that when someone is standing there waiting for us to react?
One of the most effective ways to trigger that shift is through the breath, specifically diaphragmatic breathing. By inhaling for a count of 4 and exhaling for 6 to 8, you're signaling the vagus nerve to tip your body back into the rest and digest mode. It's a physiological reset button.
I've heard it called pre-charging too. Like if you know you're heading into a tough meeting, you can do 10 cycles of that breathing beforehand to lower your baseline anxiety. It's like putting on a suit of armor before the arrows start flying.
That's a great way to put it. And if you're already in the middle of it, you can take what are called micro breaths while the other person is talking. Your abdomen expands, your heart rate variability improves, and the other person doesn't even know you're doing it. You're maintaining your composure by managing your biology in real time.
Okay, so we've got the breathing down to handle the immediate physical spike. But why is it that some people just seem less bothered by criticism in the first place? Like, if someone calls me incompetent, I might spiral, but someone else might just shrug it off.
That comes down to something called self-concept clarity. It's basically having a stable, coherent understanding of who you are that doesn't depend on what people say about you in the moment. A 2025 study on adolescents found that those with a clear sense of self reported much higher levels of meaning and purpose.
So if I know I'm a hard worker, someone calling me lazy doesn't actually threaten my identity. It just feels like incorrect data?
Exactly. When your identity is an internal anchor, social interactions stop being a referendum on your self-worth. You start seeing feedback as just data rather than a personal attack. People with this trait don't assume that a disagreement equals a rejection of them as a person. They can distinguish between their actions and their inherent qualities.
That sounds like the ultimate defense. If I'm not looking to the other person to validate who I am, they lose the power to devalidate me. But how do we build that clarity if we don't already have it?
It starts with a mindset reset. When you feel that sting of offense, you have to hit the pause button and capture the thought. Ask yourself, what am I letting them make me think right now? Often we realize we're letting someone else's drama hijack our own self-image.
It's like we're giving them permission to control our minds. I think about it as strategic unoffendability. It's not about being passive. It's about protecting your peace of mind so you can make better decisions.
Right. And that leads directly into how we interpret what the other person is doing. If we don't have that internal anchor, we tend to fall into something called hostile attribution bias, where we assume every ambiguous behavior is a calculated attack.
Hostile attribution bias. That sounds like when I see a red receipt on a text, but no reply, and immediately assume the person is mad at me or ignoring me on progress.
Precisely. Or a neutral tone of voice suddenly sounds like condescension. Research from 2024 shows that people with higher trait anger are much more likely to respond aggressively because they interpret others' behavior as intentionally hostile. But if you can reduce that bias, you see a measurable drop in reactive aggression.
So instead of assuming they're out to get me, I should be looking for situational explanations?
Yes. Instead of "they're disrespecting me," you try "they're probably stressed." Instead of "they meant to hurt me," you think "maybe that just came out wrong." It's about assuming complexity in other people rather than seeing everything through a self-referential lens.
That reminds me of the story from the sources about the woman who was devastated by a text from her sister that said, "Wow, I guess you're too busy to respond, huh?" She spent hours drafting mean replies, feeling judged and attacked, only to find out later her sister was just joking around because she knew she was busy.
That's a classic example. The emotional meltdown had nothing to do with the sister's intent and everything to do with the meaning the recipient assigned to it. When we assume the worst, we're essentially punishing ourselves for something that might not even be happening.
It's almost like we're inviting the odor of their behavior to take over our whole day. But if we can shift that interpretation, what psychologists call cognitive reappraisal, we keep those prefrontal regions of our brain online.
And that's the key. You aren't necessarily looking for the truest story, but the most useful one, the framing that keeps you calm enough to respond wisely. If telling myself, "he's just under deadline pressure," keeps me from snapping, that's a win for my mental bandwidth.
You know, even when I try to reframe things, sometimes the emotion is just too loud. It's hard to think "she's just stressed" when I'm the one being yelled at. Is there a way to get even more distance?
There is, and it's a fascinating linguistic trick. It's called self-distancing. When emotions surge, we usually think in the first person, "why am I so upset?" or "I can't believe they said that to me." But research by Cross and Iduk shows that shifting to the second or third person using your own name can dampen physiological arousal.
Wait, so I should literally talk to myself in my head like I'm someone else? Like, "why is Lena feeling triggered right now?"
Exactly. Or, "what does Lena need to stay helpful in this moment?" It sounds simple, but it creates psychological distance. It's like you're a fly-on-the-wall observer in the room rather than being stuck inside the emotional storm.
That makes so much sense. It's like I'm stepping out of the movie and into the director's chair. I'm still there, but I'm looking at the scene objectively.
And that shift actually reactivates those analytical circuits in the brain and cools down the emotional hotspots. You can even practice this after a tough interaction by journaling in the third person. Write "he felt" or "she noticed" instead of "I felt." It helps short-circuit the rumination that usually follows a conflict.
I love that. It's a way to process the event without getting sucked back into the flooding we talked about earlier. It turns the experience into data to be analyzed rather than a threat to be defended against.
Right.
And once you have that distance, you can start to use your communication as a tool for de-escalation rather than fuel for the fire. One of the most counterintuitive ways to do that is actually through listening.
Okay, Miles, help me out here. If someone is being difficult or even aggressive, the last thing I want to do is listen to them. It feels like I'm rewarding their bad behavior.
I get that, but mediation research shows that offering even 30 seconds of genuine active listening can often neutralize hostility. When people feel heard, their aggression levels tend to drop. The trick is to reflect, don't fix.
So I'm not agreeing with them, I'm just acknowledging what they're feeling.
Exactly. You use a one-sentence empathy statement, something like, "It sounds like the shifting timeline has been frustrating for you." You're paraphrasing the emotion, not necessarily the facts. This is called active empathetic listening, and it increases mutual liking, or at least reduces the feeling of being attacked.
And then you move straight to a solution?
Yes, you segue. Once you've validated that they feel heard, you ask, "Given that, what would help right now?" This shifts the conversation from a vent session to a problem-solving session. It disarms chronic complainers because you've met their human need for recognition, but haven't let them drag you into a monologue of complaints.
That's a real power move. You're acknowledging their humanity without letting their drama control the temperature of the room. But what if they don't stop? What if they keep pushing or start getting personal?
That's where the quiet boundaries come in. Composed people aren't passive. They just hold their limits without the extra drama.
I think a lot of us think setting boundaries means having a big dramatic talk or standing up for ourselves by getting loud. But you're saying there's a quieter way?
Absolutely. In fact, assertiveness studies show that staying brief is often more effective. It's called the one-sentence rule. You state your need, "I'm not available for that," or "I'm not comfortable with personal remarks," and then you just stop talking.
Oh, the silence after the sentence. That's the hard part. I always want to over-explain why I can't do something.
And that's the trap. Over-explaining makes your boundary look porous. It invites the other person to negotiate or argue with your reasoning. If you just state the limit and stop, you signal that the boundary is immovable.
And what if they keep pushing?
Then you use the broken record technique. You repeat that same one sentence verbatim. No new information, no raised volume. It's a low arousal way to show that you aren't going to budge. And if things still escalate, you use the exit option. You calmly postpone. "Let's revisit this tomorrow."
Walking away is a boundary too. I think we sometimes feel like leaving is losing, but it's actually a way to protect your mental bandwidth. If the conversation is no longer productive, there's no reason to stay in that environment.
Exactly. If you're name-calling, throwing items, or invading each other's personal space, you are in a high-conflict situation, and the best thing you can do is change your environment immediately. Go to another room, go outside for fresh air, just break the cycle of the instinct brain.
So, let's say we've successfully navigated the interaction. We breathed, we reframed, we set our boundaries, and we walked away. But I still feel that adrenaline overload. I'm still pacing the room. My heart is still pounding. What do we do then?
This is where self-soothing comes in. You need to bring your nervous system back to its baseline. One technique is self-soothing touch, like giving yourself a hug. You inhale, stretch your arms wide, and then cross them around you, holding for 3 deep breaths. It sounds simple, but it tells your body it's safe now.
I also like the idea of mindful walking, where you just walk and observe your surroundings with all your senses without judging them. It grounds you back in the present moment instead of replaying the argument in your head.
And don't forget the power of evening recovery. If you had a tough day with a difficult person, you might still be carrying that physiological arousal when you get home. Doing 2 5-minute breathing sessions after work can prevent that stress from spilling over into your family time.
It's almost like decontaminating yourself after being exposed to someone else's drama. You can also use affirmations to remind yourself of your truths. "I am in my body, I am loved, and I am grounded."
That's a great way to reestablish that self-concept clarity we talked about earlier. You're essentially telling your brain, "The threat is over, and I am still me."
I think it's also important to remember that staying calm isn't about suppressing your emotions. Suppression actually increases physiological stress and can backfire socially. It's about modulating them, acknowledging that you feel irritated, but deciding how much weight that feeling deserves.
Okay, let's pull this all together into a real-world scenario. Say you get an unexpected call from a client who is absolutely irate. They're yelling about a deadline and making it personal. Walk us through the steps.
Step one, the moment you feel your pulse surge, you start the 4-count inhale and 6-count exhale. You're resetting your physiology before you even say a word.
Step two, while they're venting, you use self-distancing. You think, what does my name need to do to stay professional right now?
Step three, cognitive reappraisal. You tell yourself, they're stressed about their launch. This is about their pressure, not my worth. You're refusing to let their odor take over your mind.
Step four, grief empathy. You say, it sounds like the shifting timeline has been really frustrating. You're neutralizing their hostility by letting them feel heard.
Step five, the quiet boundary. If they get personal, you say, I'm happy to brainstorm solutions, but I'm not comfortable with personal remarks. One sentence, then silence.
And if they don't stop?
Exit option. I think we should revisit this tomorrow when we can both focus on solutions. Then you hang up, you do your recovery breathing, and you go for a mindful walk.
It's such a clear sequence. And the best part is that every time you do this, you're actually rewiring your brain. Practicing these micro skills for a month can change your default response. Doing it for years turns composure into your character.
You become the calm one, but the real benefit is internal. You have lower cortisol, better decision-making, and an autonomy over your own mood that difficult people can't hijack.
As we bring this to a close, I'm struck by the idea that being unoffendable is actually a form of ultimate strength. It's not about being weak or letting people walk all over you. It's about refusing to give away your peace to people who are just trying to vent their own misery.
That's a great point. Real inner strength is staying free when drama knocks and just not answering the door. You don't have to win every argument or fix every misunderstanding. Sometimes the win is simply walking past the bait without taking it.
I love that. Walking past the bait. It's a great image to keep in mind next time you feel that urge to snap. Before we go, I want to encourage everyone listening to think about one quiet tactic you can try today. Maybe it's just the micro breaths during a meeting, or maybe it's trying to use your own name in your inner monologue when you feel stressed.
Just one small change can start to shift the temperature of your whole day. Remember, difficult people will always exist, but they don't have to control your mind. You have the tools now to stay grounded and keep your own smart brain in charge.
Thank you all for joining us and exploring these ideas. We hope you feel a little more equipped to handle whatever darts and jabs life might throw your way.
Take a breath, keep your boundaries, and stay unoffendable. Thanks for listening.